Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
It's the Council of Trent podcast. It's Friday, so you know what that means. It's Free for All Friday here on the Council of Trent podcast. On Tuesdays and Thursdays, we talk about apologetics, theology, philosophy, how to explain, share, and defend our Catholic faith. But on Friday, we take a little break from that just to have some fun and talk about whatever topics I find to be fascinating, and I think you'll find them to be fascinating as well. So before we get to that fascinating topic today, once again, want to give a shout out and thanks to our supporters at TrenthornPodcast.com, where for as little as $5 a month, you keep the podcast going, you help us to do rebuttal videos, you help us to do debates and dialogues. We've got a debate on atheism at the end of the month with Cosmic Skeptic. I've got a dialogue planned on Sola Scriptura, another debate on the deuterocanonical books of scripture. So much to do, so many things to be excited about. And I'm so grateful to everybody at TrenthornPodcast.com because you make it possible. So you guys get access to bonus content. We've released excerpts from my new course for the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics that we've affectionately called CASA, C-A-S-A. The course I'm teaching there is Evidence for Catholic Moral Teaching. We've got some excerpts from that just for you all as patrons to get a little taste of what that course is all about. And other bonus content we'll be releasing there as well. Be sure to go check all that out. If you're a gold level subscriber or higher, you'll get a mug with my mug on it, a mug with a Council of Trent logo, all that and more, along with exclusive ability to comment on the episodes and message me with ideas and thoughts that you have, all that at TrenthornPodcast.com. Now, on to today's Free for All Friday podcast topic. I love watching true crime documentaries. So, I'll watch them a lot sometimes on YouTube, or I'll read articles. But if I'm ever, you know, traveling in a hotel room and I'm staying in the hotel, there's not a lot on cable TV. A lot of stuff on cable TV is not good. I mean, sometimes I'll have on the background maybe the Weather Channel because I know it's inoffensive. Sometimes the Food Channel, I'm okay with Chop being on in the background. But if I want to sit down and watch TV, it's hard. There's really not a lot of good stuff on TV. But if it's late at night, I'm traveling to do a talk, I sit in my hotel room. We'll go to NBC or CNBC, one of the NBC affiliates, and they'll usually have some kind of late night Dateline episode or they're talking about some kind of true crime podcast. And I love watching through seeing like, oh, how did they solve this case or what were the clues that were involved? So I really enjoy that kind of stuff. I even liked when Making a Murderer came out, though. I didn't like, though, that people treated Making a Murderer like it was an objective documentary when it was produced by the defense attorneys for the people who were involved. So there is a bias involved in it. Maybe I'll do a whole other podcast just on that subject. But what I want to talk about today are famous elements in forensic history. So elements in the history of crime solving where there were famous firsts that came about in order to crack the case, if you will. But before we get to that, though, I want to share with you a comedy bit from John Mulaney. John Mulaney is one of my favorite comedians I love listening to. Not all of his bits are appropriate. Some you might call morally offensive. So it's not as safe as maybe something like a Brian Regan or a Jim Gaffigan. But I just like how John Mulaney does a lot of his bits. And he has one on watching shows about true crime dramas and then just about solving crimes like a long time ago, like back in the 1920s, and how it's so different from today. So let me play that for you.
What was a murder investigation like in 1935? One cop would just walk in and be like, "Detective, we found a pool of the killer's blood in that hallway." And he would just be like, gross. Mop it up. Now then, back to my hunch. Look for clues. I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll draw chalk around where the body is. That way we'll know where it was.
That way, we'll know where it was. But seriously, it's interesting to see in the history of crime solving where detectives and law enforcement develop particular procedures and methods in order to solve crimes. Here's a famous one I want to share with you that you may not have heard of. It's called The Brides in the Bath Murders. It's the story of George Joseph Smith, born 1872, died, well, executed August 1915. And he was an English serial killer, and he was involved in a very suspicious string of drowning. So he's the guy who would marry women, take out life insurance policies on them, and then the women would mysteriously die in bathtubs. And this happened over and over again. Then eventually the police were wondering, wait a minute here, this guy always marries women, then they drown in the bathtub. This can't be a coincidence. But it was one of the first cases when it went to trial where patterns of behavior were used in order to establish motive and credibility. It also included the use of forensic pathology, because even if you have this pattern, I mean, it's quite the coincidence for a guy to marry a woman, then on their honeymoon or shortly after the wedding, they mysteriously drown in their bathtubs. Like, how often does that happen to someone? But still, that's not enough to prove that it's murder, because who knows, it could be some kind of accident. I mean, it's back in the early 20th century, so you got misogynistic Trent there saying, these women must have been overcome by hysteria and drowned in the bath or something like that. So they brought in a pathologist, Bernard Spilsbury, to try to figure out what was going on, because there ended up being three victims. They drowned in the bathtub, but there's no sign of a struggle, because normally you think of a woman as sitting, let's say like an old Victorian bathtub, right? She's sitting upright. If someone were to try to push you underwater and drown you, you would fight. You might scratch the person's arms. At the very least, if you're holding the person's shoulders down, you're going to end up bruising them, or they're going to bang their elbows in the tub. There's going to be bruises, there's going to be scratches. But all three victims that Smith was married to, and then the brides who died in the bathtubs, their bodies were found. There were no bruises, no signs of a struggle. So Spilsbury was brought in to figure out, well, how could that be? So according to this article, for weeks, Spilsbury pondered over the bathtubs and the victims' measurements. Now, you see what happened. Smith said, you know, how do these women, just drown in a bathtub? Grown women don't do that. What Smith said was that, especially for his third wife, well, she had epileptic fits, he said. So she must have had an epileptic seizure and then drowned in the bathtub while he was away, and that's what happened. Spilsbury pondered this. He said that this victim, Bessie Williams' height, 5'7", and the length of the tub being 5 feet, the upper part of her body would have been pushed up the sloping head of the tub, far above the level of the water. So Spilsbury rejected that theory, that if she had had an epileptic fit, as Smith claimed, she would have stiffened her legs, they would have buttressed up against the end of the bathtub, and that would have pushed her head above the water. So that doesn't make sense, but still, how did she end up drowning? If Smith did drown her and didn't leave a mark on her or signs of struggle or a bruise, how did that happen? Using French's description of Bessie Williams when he found her in the bathtub, Spilsbury reasoned that Smith must have seized her by the feet and suddenly pulled them up toward himself, sliding the upper part of the body underwater. The sudden flood of water into her nose and throat might cause shock and sudden loss of consciousness, explaining the absence of injuries and minimal signs of drowning. So Spilsbury thinks, okay, Smith drowns his wives in the bathtub. He doesn't push them their head under or their shoulders under, because that would leave bruises and marks. So while they're lying there, he walks in front of the tub, grabs them by the ankles, yanks them up, their head goes underwater, and then they would black out very quickly. Now, how do you prove this theory? Well, it's the early 20th century, so you prove it in a highly dangerous and risky way. So here's what they did. Spilsbury had the detective involved, Arthur Neal, hire several experienced female divers of the same size and build as the victims. He tried to push them underwater by force, but there would be inevitable signs of a struggle. Neal then unexpectedly pulled the feet of one of the divers, and her head glided underwater before she knew what happened. Suddenly, Neal saw that the woman was no longer moving. He quickly pulled her out of the tub, and it took him and a doctor over half an hour to revive her. When she came to, she related that the only thing she remembered was the rush of water before she lost consciousness. Thus, Spilsbury's theory was confirmed. George Joseph Smith was arrested February 15, 1915, and then he was later executed that year, August 13, 1915, in Maidstone, Kent, England. All right, so the next one up is the St. Valentine's Day Massacre and bullet identification. So the St. Valentine's Day Massacre was the 1929 murder of seven members and associates of Chicago's North Side Gang that occurred on St. Valentine's Day. The men were gathered at a Lincoln Park garage on the morning of that feast day. They were lined up against a wall and shot by four unknown assailants who were dressed like police officers. The incident resulted from the struggle to control organized crime in the city during Prohibition between the Irish Northsiders, headed by George Bugs Moran, and the Italian Southside gang rivals led by none other than Al Capone. According to the Mob Museum website, after the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, February 14, 1929, one of the nation's foremost forensic scientists, Dr. Calvin Goddard, was hired to examine the ballistic evidence. So was it police officers who used their standard police sidearms to execute these people? Because the witnesses said they saw people dressed as police officers, or were they mob hitmen disguised as police officers using their own weapons who did this? So Goddard compared the bullets collected from the crime scene with test bullets fired by a range of firearms. He eventually found that the .45 caliber bullets from the crime scene matched two Thompson submachine guns confiscated at the rural Michigan home of a notorious mob hitman, and some of that ballistic evidence is available at the Mob Museum. So this is one of the first cases in the United States, at least, where forensic scientists used technology that would look at bullet casings to match them to particular guns, because when you fire a bullet through a casing, there are unique marks inside of the gun barrel that can show whether it's consistent with that kind of a model of a gun, or whether it came from that precise gun itself, because you can fire another bullet from that gun, you see the grooves and other imperfections in the barrel, and it'll leave traces on the bullet. This, now, Calvin Goddard was not the first person to do this. Back in England in 1835, Henry Goddard also was able to apprehend a suspect by matching a bullet retrieved at a crime scene to slugs that were made at the killer's home, because this was back in the early 19th century in England, where many people took molten lead in their own molds to make their own bullets. You didn't actually go buy bullets, you made them. And so Goddard was able to show that the bullet matched the same mold that this killer had used. Now, I don't know if they're related. I looked into this to see if these two are related. I know Calvin Goddard was the son of a police captain, and Henry Goddard is a police captain. Calvin Goddard could not be Henry Goddard's son, because Henry Goddard died before Calvin Goddard was born. But he could be his grandson. I'm not sure. I would not be surprised if they're related, but that'd be a strange coincidence of history if two different Goddards were involved, who were not related to each other, were involved in groundbreaking research and breakthroughs in the field of ballistic technology. So you never know. But that was Henry Goddard in 1835. Later, Calvin Goddard in 1929 helped to solve the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Calvin Goddard's ballistic technology was also used in the Sacco and Vanzetti trial. This is a famous trial in the early 20th century of two Italian anarchist immigrants, Sacco and Vanzetti. Though now, modern scholars reflecting back on the case believe there was not enough evidence to convict them, and it was more evidence of prejudice against immigrants at the time, and widespread fear about anarchists. And anarchists were going around bombing places. G.K. Chesterton actually wrote a book, a fictional book, about someone trying to infiltrate an anarchist gang called The Man Who Was Called Thursday. And it was about a group of anarchists who went by code names, Days of the Week, and someone trying to infiltrate that gang to stop them from being involved in bombings. But one of the pieces of evidence to try to say that the duo were involved in a robbery that went bad and ended up shooting someone was forensic ballistic technology, and Calvin Goddard was involved in that case as well. All right, here are the next two cases that deal with other breakthroughs in forensic technology. The first one would be the kidnapping of the Lindbergh baby. So on March 1st, 1932, Charles Augustus Lindbergh Jr., the 20-month-old son of aviators Charles Lindbergh and Anne Morrow Lindbergh, was abducted from the crib in the upper floor of his home in Highfields in East Amwell, New Jersey. That's so funny. I love taking my son to the Air and Space Museum here in San Diego. It's at Balboa Park. And what I love about the Air and Space Museum, I don't know if they did this on purpose, but if they did, kudos and bravo to you. The San Diego Air and Space Museum, Balboa Park, is right under the flight path that goes to Lindbergh Field here in San Diego. It's a small airport. And I love actually here in San Diego that the airport is downtown. Like, I always hate traveling to Denver, because DIA, the Denver airport, is way the heck far away from downtown Denver. It's like, oh man, you get into DIA, then you try to get downtown, it's awful. Similar with Atlanta, trying to get to the airport, get into the city. But San Diego airport's one runway right in the middle of downtown. So at the San Diego Air and Space Museum, they have an exhibit on Charles Lindbergh, who was the first person to make a solo transatlantic flight. And then later the next day, I saw my son Matthew, he was building his Legos, and he said, "Dad, I made a plane for Charles Lindbergh crossing the Atlantic." And I said, "Oh, that's really great, Matthew." He said, "Yeah, here's his plane." And then the Mosasaurus jumps out of the water and tries to eat him. But Charles Lindbergh, he has his lightsaber here, and he's able to fight the Mosasaurus. And I said, "Well, it's not entirely entirely historically accurate, but it's definitely very enjoyable to hear. So I am okay with my five-year-old's revisionist take on history. So that's my digression there on Charles Lindbergh and my adorable children. Now back to the kidnapping, though, of the Lindbergh baby. On May 12th, this is now, I go from something lighthearted to something that's much more tragic. On May 12th, the child's corpse was discovered by a truck driver by the side of a nearby road. In September of 1934, a German immigrant carpenter named Richard Hauptmann was arrested for the crime. After a trial that lasted from January to February of 1935, he was found guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced to death. Despite his conviction, he continued to profess his innocence, but then he was eventually executed in the electric chair in a New Jersey prison. Newspaper writer H.L. Mencken called the kidnapping and trial the biggest story since the resurrection. H.L. Mencken is a really funny newspaper reporter from the early 20th century. If you ever saw the movie Inherit the Wind, it's a story about the Scopes monkey trial. That was the famous evolution trial in Tennessee, where I think it was his name, John Scopes, who's put on trial for teaching evolution against Tennessee law prohibiting it. Clarence Darrow comes in to defend him. Inherit the Wind is a fictional movie documenting the case, and H.L. Mencken was the reporter on the scene. In the movie Inherit the Wind, if you ever watch it, it's a great movie. It's not entirely historically accurate, but there's wonderful performances. There's a reporter named E.K. Hornbeck, and he's a derivative of H.L. Mencken. And Mencken is someone who used these florid descriptions of things, like saying that this trial's the biggest story since the resurrection of Christ, which he didn't believe in, of course. But in any case, so one of the pieces of evidence that turned for Hauptmann, well, there were two. One, he was found with the ransom money itself. So the Lindberghs handed over tens of thousands of dollars in ransom money, hoping their son would be returned to them, which didn't end up happening. So the ransom money was marked, and then it was found it was being spent all up and down the eastern seaboard. And then later, they eventually found Hauptmann, and he possessed $14,000 of the ransom money, which he claimed that he had received from a friend, and that the friend owed him the money, and he had nothing to do with the kidnapping. But this was one of the earliest cases where handwriting analysis was used. Eight different handwriting analysis experts were brought in to examine the ransom note and then Hauptmann's own handwriting. And the similarities far outweighed any differences. And they were able to use that in order to show that Hauptmann was the one who had delivered the handwriting notes. There was also some circumstantial evidence that the wood that comprised the ladder that was used at the Lindbergh home in order to climb up to the second floor to kidnap the Lindbergh baby. The same kind of wood was found at the house and other plans that would have been used to construct a ladder like that. But the handwriting analysis was what sealed the deal in that trial. Though it's not infallible, handwriting analysis is helpful, but there are skilled forgers who can beat handwriting analysis. And another famous example of that will be the case of Clifford Irving and the great Howard Hughes hoax. So here's what happened with that. Clifford Irving was an American novelist and investigative reporter. Although he published 20 novels, he is best known for a autobiography, quote unquote, that was allegedly written by the billionaire recluse Howard Hughes. So Irving went to McGraw-Hill and claimed that he had the Howard Hughes autobiography. At that time, Howard Hughes, the very famous aviator, became incredibly wealthy, but at the end of his life, he became a recluse. He ended up staying like in his home theater for 4 months at a time. And he had like obsessive compulsive disorder, grew out the really long fingernails, urinated in jars, and had this elaborate method for his butlers and other people at the home to care for him. It's portrayed really well by Leonardo DiCaprio in the film The Aviator. So here's a clip of that, of Howard Hughes in the theater room. He's speaking into a microphone, telling them, here's exactly what you have to do to take away the jars of urine he would be in and bring him bags full of milk for him to drink. So here's that scene with Leonardo DiCaprio portraying Howard Hughes.
He is to open the bag with his right hand and hold the bag out to me at a 45 degree angle so I may reach into the bag without touching the paper. If there is any variation of these instructions, even to the smallest degree, the entire process must be repeated from the beginning.
Come in with the milk.
Repeated.
Come in with the milk.
From the beginning.
Come in with the milk.
Repeated.
Come in with the milk.
Come
in with the milk. Come in with the milk.
Repeated.
So he would repeat this over and over, and this is very sad what ended up happening to Howard Hughes. And a lot of people wanted to know about Hughes and what was going on. So McGraw-Hill was interested in this autobiography, and Irving produced two letters that he claimed were authentic from Howard Hughes, and they actually matched handwriting analysis held up, saying that, yeah, I have the autobiography. Howard Hughes gave permission for me to publish it, to record it for him, and that this is authentic. But a lot of the people came to doubt that, and it ended up being chronicled on 60 Minutes even. So here's an interview with Irving before the entire scandal fell apart, where he says he still maintains his innocence in that regard, saying, no, this is authentic.
Well, Irving doesn't stop there. He has produced two letters allegedly handwritten to him by Howard Hughes, authorizing him to proceed with the biography.
Irving says the last time he saw Howard Hughes was on December 7th. Since that time, a voice purported to be that of Howard Hughes has told reporters that he doesn't know Irving and that the whole business of the so-called autobiography is a fraud.
Have you tried to be in touch with him since? Have you tried to tell him, Mr. Hughes, come forward and say this?
I've said, Howard, speak up. Call off the dogs. I've written him a letter to the only address that I have at the moment that I know is valid, and I've used the correct code words for identification. And if he gets that letter, which apparently he hasn't so far, I presume he will surface.
So you've got Irving and these letters that seem to match Hughes' handwriting versus a voice that claims to be Howard Hughes. Remember, Howard Hughes is a recluse. He had heard about the autobiography, but he was unwilling to come out in public, even to leave his home to do a press conference or anything, to say, no, I don't know Irving. I never gave him an autobiography. I never gave him permission to publish this. All you had was his voice on the, he was willing to speak on the telephone to say, no, I'm not involved in this. But how do you prove that this voice on the phone really is Howard Hughes? Well, you use voice analysis. So this is in a book called Irrefutable Evidence, Adventures in the History of Forensic Science by Michael Curlin. It says, the sound spectrograph was developed by Bell Telephone Laboratories in 1941 to analyze the frequency of the sound of the human voice as words are spoken. It seemed possible that the characteristics of each person's voice were individual enough that someone could be identified by this graph that the spectrograph developed. It was used, for example, to identify speakers on German military radio networks during World War II. In the 1960s, at the urging of the FBI, Bell Labs did further work on voice spectrograms. Bell engineer Lawrence Kirsta did much of the research and became convinced that voice prints, as he called them, could be used for identification with a high degree of accuracy. The sound spectrograph was used in 1971 at the behest of a group of reporters who wished to verify that the voice they were listening to over the phone was in fact that of the billionaire recluse Howard Hughes. And so ultimately that and other evidence came together to show that Irving was perpetrating a hoax. He did not actually have the Hughes autobiography. He had never been in contact with Hughes. And he ended up being sentenced to 2.5 years in prison, in which he served 17 months. He later wrote a book about it called The Hoax. He published in 1981. And then in 2006, a film was released about this, starring Richard Gere as Clifford Irving, called The Hoax. You should definitely check that out if you're more interested in the story. The last case I want to talk about involves a forensic use of computer technology to catch an infamous serial killer, one of the most infamous serial killers in American history, and that'd be Dennis Rader. So Dennis Rader was known as the BTK killer or the BTK strangler. He gave himself the name BTK, which meant bind, torture, and kill. Between 1974 and 1991, Rader killed 10 people in the Wichita, Kansas metro area. Now, I'm familiar with the lore surrounding BTK because I lived in Wichita for 2 years. In fact, after a decade-long hiatus, Rader resumed sending letters in 2004, leading to his 2005 arrest and subsequent guilty plea. So how did they catch him? So Rader, like lots of serial killers like Zodiac and other killers, he loved taunting the police, and he would leave them different kinds of clues and notes trying to taunt them. And then, you know, even 10 years after his last killing, he still wanted to have that attention, and he sent more clues and other kinds of evidence to the police, thinking he wouldn't be caught. So in December 2004, Wichita police received a package from the BTK killer. This time, the package was found in Wichita's Murdoch Park. It had the driver's license of Nancy Fox, who was one of his previous victims, which was noted as stolen from the crime scene, as well as a doll that was symbolically bound at the hands and feet and had a plastic bag tied over its head. In January, Rader attempted to leave a cereal box in the bed of a pickup truck at a Home Depot in Wichita. but the box was discarded by the truck's owner. Now, why is Raider leaving random cereal boxes for people to find? Because he's a serial killer. Get it? This guy. I mean, aside from being an awful and deplorable human being, we should pray for the repose of his soul, obviously. We pray for anybody not to suffer eternal damnation. You know, Jesus said, of course, pray for your enemies, even the most vile of individuals. But on top of his vile nature, he's also incredibly corny. It was later retrieved from the trash after Raider asked what had become of it in a later message. Surveillance tape of the parking lot from that date revealed a distant figure driving a black Jeep Cherokee, leaving the box in the pickup. Later, Raider asked if his writings, if put on a floppy disk, could be traced or not. The police answered his question in a newspaper ad posted in the Wichita Eagle, saying it would be safe to use the disk. On February 16, 2005, Raider sent a purple 1.44 megabyte floppy disk. We were using floppy disks. I still used when I was a kid, when I was in junior high. So that must have been in 97, 98. I was using floppy disks to store my Word documents on 1.44 megabytes. You couldn't even hold a single MP3 on those. But there's a website called Retro Sounds where you can hear all kinds of retro sounds. And one of them is the sound of a floppy disk being inserted into a computer, if you're nostalgic for that. He sent it to Fox TV affiliate KSAS TV in Wichita. Also enclosed was a letter, a gold-colored necklace and medallion, and a photocopy of a cover of the book Rules of Prey, a 1989 novel about a serial killer. So police looked at the floppy disk to look at the documents Raider sent, but they found something. They found metadata embedded in a deleted Microsoft Word document that was unknown to Raider, still stored on the floppy disk. So he had a document that was on there. He must have deleted it from the disk, but there was still remnants of code and data from the file on the floppy disk, even though it had been deleted. And the metadata that was contained in the deleted remnants of this file contained the words Christ Lutheran Church. And the document was modified by Dennis. Because, you know, when you get your old computer, even today, when you get your Microsoft computer, you register it, you fill everything out, you put your name on it. So police found this and they saw these clues, Christ Lutheran Church and Dennis. So an internet search determined that internet search, like what, Alta Vista, asked Jeeves, that a Dennis Raider was president of a local Christ Lutheran Church council. When investigators drove by Raider's house, a black Jeep Cherokee, remember the one that was seen in the Home Depot surveillance footage, was parked outside. This was strong circumstantial evidence, but it was not enough to get a warrant. It was not enough to go and arrest him. So then the police, they suspected Raider heavily. They were able to obtain DNA from Raider's daughter, and that showed a familial match between that and DNA that was found from one of the victim's fingernails, and it showed there was a familial match from the daughter's DNA to the DNA under a victim's fingernails, and that was enough to arrest Raider, and that was how the infamous BTK killer was brought down. Oh, and by the way, that hidden data stuff, that's why I am really, really, really hesitant to post pictures online, and you should be hesitant, by the way, of posting pictures of your child's school, your home, your work. I only usually post pictures when I'm out and about with my family, like at a, you know, if we're at Balboa Park or we're at the zoo or we're flying on an airplane. I don't post pictures online of our home or other things like that because there is data, XFEXIF data, embedded within photos that can be used for geotagging, that you can know the latitude and longitude of where a photo was taken, the date and time that it was taken at, what kind of phone it was taken on, and that can be used to expose your privacy. There's an article about it on Consumer Reports. I'll leave that under the description at trendhornpodcast.com if you want to read more. The article's called How a Photo's Hidden EXIF Data Exposes Your Personal Information. This is how the article begins. There's a particularly arresting black and white image of a boy on Flickr. He stands at home plate in his Little League uniform. Early evening, he seems to be 8 or 9 years old. The lighting is dramatic. He's partly in shadow, in a sharp silhouette. There's no caption and few visual clues as to where or when the picture was captured. But download the file and click through some menus, you can learn a lot. We can see the picture is about a year and a half old. The boy's game took place on June 6, 2018. The time was 7:15 p.m. Get some GPS data and you can learn where the boy was playing. He was on a dirt baseball diamond behind a church in a small town in Ohio, a location we won't name. So just be careful of that with your own digital data or pictures you upload. I would recommend not posting, you know, you might still post pictures of your home, you know, what have you. That's fine, I suppose. But just know that sometimes that data. Just like, you know, when they found Raider, they found metadata in deleted files on a floppy disk. You can find that other kind of stuff and your pictures as well through geotagging, other things like that. So, hey, I hope you enjoyed our whirlwind tour of fascinating cases involving forensics. I love doing Free For All Fridays. It's fun to share interesting stories that I read about that I think you'll enjoy as well. I'll leave links to what I spoke about in the description of this episode at trendhornpodcast.com. Another perk, by the way, if you're a supporter at trendhornpodcast.com, you get access to show resources and notes that we don't post with the regular podcast description. Special perk for our subscribers at trendhornpodcast.com. Check that out. Thank you all so much. I hope you have a real blessed day and a really blessed weekend.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit trendhornpodcast.com.